The truth is that fraud is an issue as long as humans have been on the planet. You know, fraud has existed. It is a huge investment that is made by the banks. But on the whole, in the UK, we spend, let's say, a large bank could spend £50 million a year, but they're catching 50% of the fraud. We're still allowing 50% of the fraud through. One of the things that's really difficult for banks is to be able to convince their customer that they are being scammed, because they really are convinced that what they're doing largely is to try and help somebody else.
From the first-time founders to the funds that back them, innovation needs different. Our episode partner, HSBC Innovation Banking, is proud to accelerate growth for tech and life science businesses, creating meaningful connections and opening up a world of opportunity for entrepreneurs and investors alike. Discover more at www.hsbcinnovationbanking.com/en-gb. Hello and welcome to the UKTM podcast, a weekly chat with the movers and shakers of the UK tech industry and the destination for all things UK tech related. And today I'm joined by Martina King, the CEO of Featurespace, a fintech company that is helping banks fight fraud. Welcome, Martina.
Hello. Hi, Jane. Good to meet you.
Now, first of all, tell me a little bit about the problems that Featurespace is trying to solve.
Yeah, well, it's a big problem for society, and it's something that humans can't battle with on their own any longer, and a technology solution is required. And the technology, when I was first introduced to it, I was told that it was a fundamental invention, and really it was a very early version of AI, and it's adaptive behavioral analytics. And the problem that we were looking for with the technology, we needed a big real-time data set because, again, if it's a small data set, humans can still make sense of it. If it's big and it's real-time, that's really a problem for the machines to solve. So we were looking for a big real-time problem. And one that we could see that technologies that were existing in the world at that moment in time were going to be replaced by a new, better version. And ultimately, it led us to looking at financial crime and the following of transactions and money movement. And so if you could protect people, if you could learn the patterns of normal good behavior in a transaction, then the bad would start to stick out. And before Featurespace, people would just model what bad looked like. And so by modeling everything in a great big real-time payment data set, you could get far greater accuracy. And the accuracy is a statistical problem, and it means that the more accuracy we have on being able to identify a good transaction means more business can flow. And conversely, if we can identify a bad transaction or a fraudulent transaction, it means that we can protect society. And ultimately, that led to us being able to build a mission around making the world a safer place to transact. So we protect payments, and that's what we turn up every day to do, and that's our single-minded focus.
I mean, you've come at this at a time when we're in an epidemic, it seems, of scamming. I opened up my email today and there was an email telling me that I need to make a payment on a parcel. There was this one's quite funny. It was a phishing email that said, "You've been haked." I think they misspelt it, but the fish analogy did make me laugh. And then saying that it had some, compromising photos of me and I had to pay them in Bitcoin. I mean, it's just immense, the amount. I would just like to say to all our listeners, there were no compromising pictures of me. Well, I very much hope for the world's sake that there aren't. We are literally bombarded by these scams on a daily basis. So just paint me a picture, if you can, of what you see as being the kind of worst offenders in this scam landscape from your point of view.
Well, I mean, the truth is that fraud is an issue. As long as humans have been on the planet, fraud has existed. And they are expert at their trade, at their crime. And, when I first came into Featurespace over 10 years ago and we were really looking at protecting payments, card fraud was the big, big issue and remains an enormous issue. But of course, with the rise of the internet and online banking and real-time payments, being able to effectively control an individual and get them to believe that you're genuine and find a way of being able to manipulate them out of their money has become a very lucrative way for criminals to be able to make money. And, you know, it's such an enormous problem. If you just look at the UK alone, 1.2 billion last year lost in fraud and scams. And, you know, our poor police force can't keep on top of it. And so therefore, one of the ways in which we support the industry is by being able to continue to invent new technologies to keep pace with the new types of methodologies that are being applied. And of course, one of the things that's fascinating about when we were first using AI to solve the problem is that where people were modelling what bad looked like before, it was known fraud attacks. But if you turn that on its head and you just really look at what a normal good transaction is for society, then you end up with a far better result. You can really start to protect people. If you're doing that across a huge data set, all payments, let's say, in the UK, you need a combination of really smart platform processing, but at the same time, incredibly smart analytics to be able to have high accuracy at identifying a good transaction and blocking a bad one.
Now, obviously, banks that are working, partnering with you are doing something about this problem. But in general, do you think that banks are doing enough to combat this, the issue of scams and financial fraud?
None of us can ever do enough. But my goodness, they invest a huge amount every single year. So a, you know, kind of a typical stat will be a big bank will spend something like £50 million a year on anti-fraud prevention systems. They'll have a multi-layered approach, so it won't be one vendor, there'll be multiple vendors that they'll be working with. Then they have their own internal teams, they have data scientists themselves, but they also then have their analysts that are working on these cases on a day-to-day basis. So it is a huge investment that is made by the banks. But on the whole, in the UK, we spend, let's say, a large bank could spend £50 million a year, but they're catching 50% of the fraud. We're still allowing 50% of the fraud through. And that, again, is a technology problem and it's a problem for statistics. So how can we improve that catch rate? How do we catch more fraud, but at the same time, don't block those good transactions? Because we still want, and this is what customers deserve and demand, which is I don't want my transaction to be blocked. So high accuracy on a good transaction, but equally even better controls and stronger accuracy on what a bad transaction looks like.
And just this month in October, we've seen new regulations around controlling that very thing. Banks are able to hold suspicious transactions for up to 4 days. Is that a good thing? Is that going to help? Or will it in fact hold up some payments that perhaps look suspicious but aren't?
Well, this is the thing, isn't it? It's, you know, if you're under the spell of a criminal who's scamming you right now, then it's really hard to break that spell. But the technology already has spotted that you're under the spell. And so one of the things that's really difficult for banks is to be able to convince their customer that they are being scammed. Because the, you know, they really are convinced that what they're doing largely is to try and help somebody else. So they're moving the money to be able to support somebody because they're really convinced this person's in trouble or they really need money in order to be able to help them. So the technology has high accuracy in being able to spot that that's exactly the type of attack that's taking place. And so therefore, how do you save that individual from themselves? And one of the ways in which you can do that is you can say, I'm just going to block the transaction and give the individual time to cool down and then to be able to stop and think. Because with real-time payments, the criminal knows that if they put the pressure on the individual, do it now, move the money now, I really need the, it's the urgency that's causing the part of that story that they're involving you in is the urgency of moving the money. So if you can get the individual to that transaction not to be processed, then at least that victim of that crime is able to say, well, it's not my fault. I can't move the money. It's my bank. Then, of course, the individual is phoning the bank and saying, why haven't you moved the money? And that's very difficult for banks to handle. Very difficult when you have a customer who's saying, you must move this. And these conversations take place across the banking industry every single day, where an individual is talking to somebody in the bank and they're saying, we really think that you're being scammed. Stop and think about this. But the customer on the other end is so convinced they're still saying, they're still authorizing. This is the thing, it's an authorized push payment. No, you absolutely have to move the money. So sometimes I think it's absolutely, I do support this, where for the best of society, for the best of the individual, for the best of the customer, let's just stop that transaction for a few days and make sure that you still come back to this in a little while to make sure this is a genuine transaction you still want to make.
HSBC Innovation Banking, our partner for this episode, provides commercial banking services, expertise and insights to the technology, life science and healthcare, private equity and venture capital industries. To find out why innovation needs different, go to www.hsbcinnovationbanking.com/en-gb. And it always amazes me, actually, that banks often refund people after scams. My daughter thought she was buying herself some help with her driving license, speeding up the process of applying for a driving license. It turned out to be a scam. The bank refunded me. She used my card, of course. She's a teenager. I've been caught out buying goods on social media sites that never turned up, and I've had those refunded by my banks. And in cases of romance fraud, where people give thousands and thousands of pounds away, banks often refund them. And now part of the new regulations is that banks will sort of be required to do this. It's surprising that it's that the onus is put on banks, I feel. But what are your thoughts on that?
Well, the UK is very advanced in the way it's handling scams and looking after the victims of these crimes. And that then puts more pressure, if you like, on the bank to be able to verify that this is a genuine transaction. So, I do welcome this. I think it's a good thing for society. And actually, if the bank can identify a bad transaction and block it and stop it, well, then we need that level of protection to be put in place for us. I do think, on the other hand, it's tough on banks, but we are advanced in the UK, and other geographies and other territories and countries are looking at us and saying, goodness, this is really quite a big step by our regulators to support society. But of course, ultimately, somebody has to pay for this. And if a big bank is investing tens of millions, sometimes hundreds of millions in these systems to be able to stop the crime, then consumers will have to pay for this in some way, shape or form. And that again is where, if you're a regulated bank, at least as consumers, we have the confidence of knowing that the banks now have to put all these systems in place and the governance around protecting us.
Now, a lot of these scams happen on social media sites. And last week, I don't know if you saw this news, but Revolut called on social media companies like Meta to take the burden of repaying victims. So moving it away from payment providers to these social media platforms where often people are getting caught in these scams. I wonder what you thought about that.
Well, this is an interesting one, isn't it? I think that if you're looking at the governance that goes around the movement of money, some of the more traditional banks have been doing it for a very long time, and the governance processes are incredibly well established. And sometimes when you're a new business, the drive is to onboard new customers and win new business almost at any cost, because it's about gaining market share. So then the question is, have the right governance processes and practices been put in place simultaneously when you're trying to grow your business? And that's tricky for companies that are growing very quickly. But that's where the regulator now, I think, is stepping in to say more needs to be done to protect society.
So it's been quite the journey for Featurespace. You mentioned earlier that this grew out of Cambridge University. You've obviously then scaled up. You've been brought in as a CEO. You've gone international. The latest news on your journey is that Visa has signalled its intent to acquire you, which is obviously subject to regulatory approval. So let's break that down. Should we start with the Visa stuff? Because I know that's probably been taking up a lot of your time recently. What are your thoughts on acquisition? And what would your advice be to other founders who are perhaps on the verge of being acquired by a big corporation?
It's a really good question. One of the things that, you know, when you're building a business and when you're an entrepreneur, investors will often say, well, what's your end game? What's your exit strategy? And my answer to that was always, we serve our customers. And if we make sure that our customers are happy first and foremost, and they like our service, and they pay us, and they buy additional services from us, we won't really worry too much about the end game, because it will work itself out. Either we will be of such strategic value to an organisation, which is ultimately what's happened now with Visa, or alternatively, we've built such a good business, we'll be able to go onto a capital market if that's what we choose to do. And we think, again, that's best for us, our investors, and also then for our customers. So as it's turned out, we didn't actually set out to say what the outcome was going to be, other than to continue to build a really good business to serve our customers and to make sure that we had the good old-fashioned metrics of great customer success, terrific growth, and then building a profitable business.
And in terms of you coming in as a CEO, this is another thing that lots of founders will be grappling with. You know, lots of people that are listening to this podcast, they might have come up with a great idea. They might be running a startup. They might be feeling very burnt out by the fact that they're sort of running this on their own. It may well then be time to bring in a CEO. Is there a good time to bring in a CEO, in your opinion? And how did it go specifically for you when you joined Featurespace?
Well, I'd come out of launching an augmented reality business that was inside Autonomy PLC. And it was Mike Lynch who said, well, look, Martina, I'd like to introduce you to my lifelong friend, Professor Bill Fitzgerald. He and his PhD student, Dave Excel, have invented a brand new technology, a fundamental technology, but they need somebody to help them find a commercial path. I'm going to take this idea and going to look at the cyber market. And so therefore, Darktrace was born out of that. And so he said, go find your way with Featurespace. And that was really exciting. So I had the endorsement of Mike and his deep domain expertise in technology, saying they've really got something special here. But ultimately, it's only going to work if you can find a great use case and scale a product and build a company around that and satisfy your customers. So I joined very early. We had one customer who was using the technology for fraud and a whole host of other examples of potential use cases. And of course, the thing is, it was AI original gear. So, you know, we were like imagining the world of AI. What can we do with this technology? So all the use cases that you see today, we sort of sat around tables and imagined them. But the components all came together around wanting to build technology that was going to be really good in the world. You know, sort of, if we're going to turn up to work every day, we want to do something that's going to really make a difference for society. And what could that possibly be? And also, it has to be real time, because our technology works best when it's making decisions on huge data sets in real time. And the more a gentleman called Roger Alexander, said, very inquisitive man, really terrific individual. It's all about people, isn't it? I mean, it's like you meet individuals and they point you in a direction. And he said, you know, go and learn about the payments industry, Martina. You'll revolutionize it. And that's then when we found that the problem of fraud was ripe for disruption. There was a real need for a different, any new way of solving the problem. So to come back to your question, it was still very much a concept stage when I became involved. And the first job was, how do we find product market fit? How do we build a product around that? How do we find customers? And then how do you scale your company? And then how do you, you know, sort of really build out a leadership team and a workforce to serve the market that you've decided to support and help?
And on those points, again, all problems that scale-ups will have, when do you go international? Do you go international? Do you sometimes have to completely change the original purpose that you designed your product or your idea for to fit into something else? What are your tips around that, about transitioning and growing?
It's a great question, because I imagined, you know, with the team, we had so many different ideas for what Featurespace's technology could do. For instance, we had images of skin lesions. So, you know, using predictive analytics, could you do the visual recognition? Could you identify the moment of change in a skin lesion, encourage somebody to go off to the doctor? But actually what happened was, the scientist came back to me and said, yeah, it can work, but the images are not smart enough yet, and the AI isn't smart enough for us to be able to identify correctly and accurately the moment of change. So our false positive rate is going to be too high. We're going to be sending too many people without problems to the doctor. That's not a good outcome for society. We were looking at drill bits and for oil wells and the predicting the moment of change that was going to be necessary because of the sheer costs of closing down the production of an oil well, crop rotation. Bill's methodology was being used to predict when the energy that's stored in the Earth's oceans would be causing catastrophic storm damage, for instance. So, you know, we're starting to see that his work that he did early days in the university is now being used for the weather pattern predictions that we see today. So fascinating in terms of an academic study, but how do you turn that into a company? And how do you find a use case where you can have a whole range of global customers and do something that's better than anyone's ever done it before? And that really was the exciting moment. That was our eureka moment at Featurespace when we were given access to card payment data and asked to beat what was then the world's best. And we didn't just outperform a little bit, we massively improved the results. So we were able to identify 40% more fraud and reduce the number of wrongly identified a good genuine transactions by 70%. So you can then put a value, a calculation on that, and then you scale that up against the world's transactions, and all of a sudden you've got a very exciting business.
And so for others that are kind of thinking of doing this, what did you feel worked particularly well when you were searching for a good product use, and also for the scaling up? Is it a gut feeling that, you know, now's time to open offices in the US, we've grown to a certain size? When do you make that decision?
Yeah, I think a lot of it is opportunity based. So once there were lots of trial and errors, we did all sorts of things. And I think that kind of quick fail mentality is incredibly important with young companies, because you don't know. If you start with saying it's definitely going to be this, until you go and try and test it in the market, you don't know whether it's going to work or not. So that kind of, let's test it, let's see if it's going to work. Can we actually find a customer that's going to be on the back end of that? If the answer to that is no, or it's going to be too problematic, or the market's declining, it's not big enough, you have to say, right, well, we tried that, close that, now move on to the next thing. But once you find it, once all the components are ripe for disruption, you then laser-like just focus on that one thing. And once we found the mission to make the world a safer place to transact, we just said, we just stick to that and do not get distracted. So once you know that, it's then a question of, well, which are the markets that are the ones then that are most likely to need our technology? And, you know, some markets, as we can see through all of the statistics, are more prone to financial crime than others. So you can start there. And then you start to build a reputation. So as customers really like what you're doing for them, they then make an introduction and they say, you need to go and speak to so-and-so, they would love your technology. And you start building a cohort of fans, people who are real advocates. And so once you get that network going, then they're going to make those introductions. And sometimes those introductions are going to be in another country. And how we did it at Featurespace was a fly-in, fly-out basis. So we would go in with our engineers, our scientists, with commercial people, go wrap ourselves around the customer and solve the problem for them in that country. And then you use that hero customer in that region to then become an advocate and go tell other people that they know to use your technology. So it takes quite a long time to build it that way. But when your systems are big enterprise systems and you're selling to a business-to-business community, I think that's probably the best way of doing it. Word of mouth, trust, building relationships. Do you know, they still really work in business.
And one of the questions I seem to be asking startups over and over again is what we do in the UK we're very good at growing startups. We're very good at having great ideas out of Cambridge University and all the other universities around the country, but turning them into sort of huge businesses that then are able to plough money back into the UK economy, which is ultimately the aim of this stuff, it seems to have been a bit more elusive. Any thoughts on how we improve that?
Jane, I was at an event last night, and it was a wonderful event at the London Stock Exchange for female founders. But there was a good cross-section of the sexes in the room. But one of the questions I asked was, you know, put your hand up if you consider yourself to be a salesperson. And not every hand went up. In fact, quite a few hands, the majority of hands stayed down. And of course, you know, when you learn the language of the boardroom, it's about the money, it's about doing deals, it's about the way in which you can grow your business. And if you're a young entrepreneur and you're starting out, it's about persuasion. You've got to be able to inspire people that your vision for the future is something that others are going to want to be able to be part of. That's selling. And ultimately, if you're going to make a great business-to-business company, you've got to be able to persuade people to try you, to give it a go. And a great commercial team is the way in which you achieve that. So our laser-like focus has been, how do we win the hearts and mind of the customer? How do we absolutely delight them? How do we turn them into an advocate because what we've done for them is so valuable? And then how do they go out and tell others? And that's genuine and it's authentic and it is a great way to build partnerships. And I think sometimes in the UK, we don't look at sales that way. We have a perception that it's not very sophisticated, but actually it's incredibly sophisticated. And if you get it right, it's really exciting. So I think perhaps a shift in our mentality towards selling and salesmanship, you know, for instance, you can get a professorship in selling in the US, but in the UK, it's even hard to be able to get selling on an MBA course. So I think we just need to open our minds a little bit more to being receptive to getting out there and doing some deals.
That's a really good point. I don't think anyone's made that one before. Now, I'm going to ask the final question. And you mentioned female founders. I always find it astonishing that I'm still talking about this as a problem. But being a female in fintech is particularly hard. But we're also struggling to get equality when it comes to the number of startups that are founded by women. Any final thoughts on what we do to sort of... Well, I don't think we're going to solve that problem in 2 minutes.
We're not going to solve the problem in 2 minutes. However, I was so inspired by the female founders that I saw yesterday. And the truth of the matter is we're here and we're doing it. And in fact, you know, when I look at Poppy Gustafsson at Darktrace and, you know, Raspberry Pi and Starling Bank and, you know, Luminance, another AI company out of Cambridge being run by Eleanor, a female, you know, what we've done at Featurespace. I just think there are so many great case studies now of incredibly successful deep technology companies that are being run by women. And we're really good at it. We're really good at it. So if investors want great returns, they find great women to run companies in order to be able to achieve them for them. So we've got, in pattern recognition, quite a few of us who've been able to do that.
Well, that's a perfect way to end. And we have run out of time, sadly. Thank you, Martina King, for all of your thoughts. That was a really interesting discussion. And thank you as well to everybody who's been listening. We will be back with another episode next week. But in the meantime, you can keep up to date with all the latest UK tech developments at www.uktech.news. Don't forget to follow UKTN on LinkedIn and X, where you can also get in touch with me at Jane Wakefield with your comments and suggestions about the show. Until next time, it's goodbye from me. HSBC Innovation Banking, our partner for this episode, provides commercial banking services, expertise, and insights to the technology, life science and healthcare, private equity, and venture capital industries. To find out why innovation needs different, go to www.hsbcinnovationbanking.com/en-gb.